Chapter 2, The Economic Environment. In this chapter, we will explore the essential characteristics of the economic environment in which business operates. We will explore the competing perspectives about how best to create a successful economy, and we'll critically assess the way in which markets work and their role in creating a favourable economic environment. Towards the end of the chapter, we look at the evolution of the global economic environment, particularly since the end of the Second World War, although our historical perspective can be a little bit longer, going back to the start of the Industrial Age, which started at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century. And last but not least, we'll seek to analyse the competing perspectives about the role of markets, the private sector, and governments, the public sector, in organising economic activity to produce the most favourable environment in which business can operate. We start the chapter by looking at the basic economic problem. It's argued that on planet Earth we have an existential problem, that at any one moment in time we're faced with the problem of having finite resources. Resources in the form of labour, natural resources or land, capital and enterprise. At any one moment in time, we would argue that those resources are limited, but the problem that we have as in terms of the human race is that our needs and wants are unlimited, we're insatiable. No matter what seems to be produced out of the economy, we want more and more and more and more, which obviously gives rise to a big problem. We can't have everything that we want, or the planet certainly can't have everything that it wants. My mother used to put this to me in an individual way in the form of, you can't have your cake and eat it. We can't have everything. We can't have everything that our hearts desire. If we can't have that as individuals, then how can the 7 to 8 billion people who inhabit the planet have everything they need? So you can see the economy on a daily basis as one where every day all 7 to 8 billion of us are screaming at the planet, give me more, give me more, give me more. But the planet hasn't got the resources to do that. On a microeconomic level, then, if we zoom down and look at a micro level, we can look at one simple economic decision. In the book, I give you an example of building houses or building student apartments or building education resources, a library. Let's imagine that we have £1 million worth of resources in the form of labour, land, capital and enterprise, but we have three different building projects, A, B and C. If we decide we're going to have A, then effectively what we've decided not to do is to have B and C. We cannot deny that whatever choice we make as human beings, the economic choice we make in terms of allocating our resources, there's going to be an opportunity cost in that we're going to have to give up something. That is probably, I would argue, the single most important thing to take away from this chapter. Economic life is a hard one because of scarcity. Whenever we make a decision to use resources in one way, there's a lost opportunity of things that we can't have. Economists refer to that then as the allocation problem. And then, of course, we could have big debates about whether or not A was the right thing to do, or whether we should have produced B, or whether we should have produced C. In other words, economics is a controversial subject. The economic environment is controversial because it's full of debates and disagreements. And that's, for me, as an economist, that's what makes economics such an interesting subject. If we decided to produce A, the library or the student apartments or the house, how are we going to produce it? Are we going to produce it using lots of labour in a labour intensive way or a capital intensive way? Are we going to produce it in such a way that the housing sector is dominated by one large company, which has lots of expertise and opportunities to benefit from things like economies of scale? Or would we much rather have lots of different firms competing for the contract? What would be the best way of organising the production? Or are we going to use highly technological ways of producing the houses, or relatively simple technology? Or are we going to have the public sector providing the construction project, or should it be done through the private sector? There's a whole host of issues there to do with the production problem. And last but not least, then, we have the distribution problem. Who's going to get what we've built? How do we decide who gets and therefore who doesn't get? In other words, the distribution problem. So in economics, then, you learn about the basic economic problem of scarcity. You'll learn about scarcity then, meaning there are three problems: allocation, what to produce, production, how to produce, and finally distribution, who gets what's produced. You can see then that there are possible arguments in relation to economics, in relation to the answers that we can give for economic problems. However, let's look at this notion of scarcity in itself, because scarcity itself can be argued about. Some people, when they look at scarcity, might argue in this way: we're never going to satisfy all our needs and wants and desires because they're infinite and resources are finite, so we might as well not do anything, might as well pack up and go home. Other people, though, more optimistically, will say, let's accept that we've got scarcity, but we can at least have a go at improving our standards of living by producing more economic growth through more efficient use of limited resources. Other people, though, say, but surely, if the problem in the short term is that we haven't got enough resources to go around, and if we're living in a world where relatively few people get a huge slice of the cake and relatively many people get a small slice of the cake, surely it's an immediate win to simply organise the economy by redistributing income and wealth so that we take money, resources from the rich and give to the poor, and actually the welfare of humanity will be maximised. And that's an issue we'll explore in more detail in Chapter 12. And then last but not least, we've got people who say, yeah, but let's not forget that in the pursuit of trying to improve standards of living, in trying to resolve this basic economic problem of infinite needs and wants and finite resources, let's be absolutely conscious of the fact that our resources are finite. And if we try to exploit the resources of the planet to far too high a degree, we'll actually end up shooting ourselves in the foot, and we'll end up living in an unsustainable way and actually undermining the essential ecosystem on which we all depend. In other words, as you'll see, I refer then to four different ways of looking at the economic problem. We can look at neoclassical writers who very much look at that second definition of scarcity. Let's have a go. Let's have a go at improving our standards of living by making more efficient use of resources. And the best way of doing that is through relying on the private sector and markets. We then have another group of economists who I refer to as interventionists or structuralists, who again accept the second definition of scarcity. We can at least have a go at improving our standards of living. But for them, it's not markets in and of themselves that are going to be the answer. It's a partnership between markets and the government. There's a much greater need for governments, and that's something that we will explore in many of the chapters throughout the book. The third perspective that we look at then is what I refer to as a radical or Marxist perspective, who very much argue that the real problem in economics is the distribution problem. Their starting point is that in the world in which we live, which for most of us in the world is a capitalist market economy, the real problem we face is that the rich have too much and the poor have too little, which mean that all the economic signals that are sent out are wrong. Goods are produced for the rich. They're produced in a way which make the rich happy, and when goods are being distributed, it tends to be the rich that get them and not the poor. And therefore, our primary problem has to be a distribution problem. And then finally, particularly in the later part of the 20th century, as we move into the 21st century, we do now have a green or an ecological perspective that keeps saying, look, a plague on all your houses. Be careful that in pursuing economic growth, we don't undermine the sustainability of the planet. And I think it's important, as you, as students of business, who maybe may or may not be new to economics, is that you are aware then of this different level of complexity in economics, the different theoretical, ideological debates that take place about the nature of economics. Having looked at the philosophical issues about the nature of economics, then we then plunge into the theoretical model of why it might be that markets are the best way of organising economic activity. What I do in the chapter and explore with you then is I outline to you the theoretical market model using a technique that economists refer to as equilibrium analysis. In the second part of the chapter, then, you will explore how markets operate. You will look at demand, consumers, what determines consumer behaviour in markets, and you'll look at producers. Producer behaviour, what determines producer behaviour in markets. You will see that theoretically, consumers resolve the economic problem, the allocation problem, by simply going into the marketplace and being prepared to pay a price. In being prepared to pay a price, they signal to producers their needs, and producers, because they want to make profits, will seek to meet the demands of consumers. In other words, what brings consumers and producers together is price. That's the way in which they talk to each other. It's not just price, though. There are a whole range of other influences which affect consumers' decisions and producers' decisions, and we look at that in the chapter. However, the implication of market analysis is that provided that there's no outside agency, markets will operate in such a way as to match the needs and the desires of consumers with the needs and desires of producers to make profits in such a way that everybody's going to be happy. And in all markets, everybody will be happy. In other words, we'll end up in a situation that economists refer to as equilibrium. I would encourage you then to take your time on this part of the chapter and to go through the theoretical analysis, and hopefully by the end of that, with that investment in time, you will be able to have a good appreciation then of why it is that so many people believe that markets are such a marvellous way of organising economic activity. However, there are problems with markets. One obstacle, curveball that we throw in is when we look at the nature of demand, and particularly the nature of demand in relation to price. We know that almost always when prices go up, demand goes down. When prices go down, demand goes up. But how much does demand go up or down? What's the elasticity of demand? Let's take, for example, a market in which there are lots of companies competing. If there are lots of companies competing, that means the market's going to be very price sensitive. So, for example, if I as a company put my price up and my competitors don't, then I'm going to lose a lot of demand, or we'd say the demand is elastic. On the other hand, if I manage to get my price down and they don't change their price, then I might have a big increase in demand. In other words, we'd say the demand facing my product is highly elastic. If that were the situation in markets, then all of the incentives for producers would be genuinely to try to compete on price, and that way they'd make more money. But imagine I was operating in a market where I was the only firm or one of relatively few firms. If I put my price up, the demand might go down, but because people really want my commodity and they've got nowhere else to go, although the demand might go down, it might only go down by a little bit. Well, if my price goes up a lot, my demand only goes down by a little bit, I actually end up making more money. In other words, in markets where we have monopoly corporations, there's a real danger that monopoly businesses will seek to exploit consumers by pushing prices up. In other words, the free market won't give consumers what they want. In other words, in those markets, then we'll have big business with too much power and consumers who will be defenceless. And therefore, interventionists and structuralists will say, we need to have intervention, Marxists would say, and that's one of the major problems with capitalism. It does lead to a concentration of ownership and at least to a concentration of power in the hands of the very few. We then look in the chapter a whole range of other areas in which markets can go wrong. Let's take allocation. Allocation being what is it we're going to produce? What happens if you as a consumer want to have education, you want to have access to health, you want to have good housing, but you don't have enough money to afford it? Well, in a market system, you don't count. You don't have the ability to pay. But we as a society might argue that by merit, you have a right to a decent house, a decent education, a decent health provision. In other words, then, there is a strong prima facie case for governments to step in, particularly where people lack the ability to pay for certain goods, and provide those goods. Of course, we could then argue about the extent to which those things should be provided and what are merit goods, etc. There's another range of goods referred to as public goods. These are goods which, if they're going to be provided to one person, have to be provided to everybody. Take a classic example of street lighting. If I, as an inhabitant on a road, want to walk home safely at night with street lighting, and I want to pay for it, and then I pay for it, I can't stop other people sharing in the light. But if they're not prepared to pay for it, then the lights wouldn't be provided and we do all lose out. In other words, there are certain goods which have to be provided on an all or nothing basis. They're often referred to as public goods. Another area where markets fail is where my individual decision to buy something is not just a private thing to me. It might have spillover effects, or what we refer to as externalities. So, for example, if I'm driving a motor car, it's my individual decision whether I'm going to put petrol in my car or not, and I have to pay for that, and there's a private cost and a private benefit to me of the petrol. But there's also a social cost, in that when I'm in my car driving, I am burning all sorts of bad gases which go up into the atmosphere and which have a detrimental effect on other people. Therefore, we could argue in that sense the market has failed. And there's a whole range of externalities there which we might think that governments have a responsibility to try to sort out. In relation to production, a whole set of problems. I've already referred to the problem of monopoly. What happens if markets get controlled by big business with high degrees of monopoly power? Very often it makes sense to only have one company, because that company will be much more efficient because, for example, it's got more money for research and development, or it can benefit from economies of scale. But if we've only got one company, or one or two large companies, while potentially that has great advantages in terms of economic efficiencies, what happens if they abuse their political power in the marketplace to exploit consumers? How do businesses then resolve that position? Often you can have markets which are competitive, but they're too competitive and you have a race to the bottom. Do we really want, for example, a truly competitive airline industry where, in trying to compete against each other, they save money on safety to the detriment of passengers? Well, no. One of the arguments there is have competition, but you need to have a very strong regulatory authority to ensure that those companies have adequate safety regulations in place. I've referred to the problems of elasticities of demand earlier on. And what we've been looking at there is individual examples of where markets can fail. At the aggregate level, at the so-called macroeconomic level, economies often can go through periods of growth, but also periods of stagnation. And therefore, it's argued that governments need to intervene. So in other words, what you hopefully you'll learn in the chapter then is not only the theory of how markets work, but you'll also see situations in which markets don't work. And we'll begin to get you to think about then areas in which potentially then there needs to be intervention in markets and what forms of intervention those must take. We end the chapter then by doing a very brief run through of what's happened to global capitalism, particularly since the end of the Second World War. At the end of the Second World War, we can see that this problem of state and market was resolved in different ways in different parts of the world. In the immediate post-1945 period, we talked about a world of three worlds: a first world, the West; the second world, the world of communism, particularly centred around the rise of the Soviet Union and then China in Southeast Asia. But then also the third world, the developing world, countries which had once been colonies of the major European powers, which had now become decolonized and were seeking their own independent economic policy. And what you learn is that those different areas of the world sought to resolve their economic problems in different ways. Despite those differences in policy, what they all had in common, though, was a certain degree of pessimism about the ability of markets to resolve all economic problems. And what all three systems had in common, to vastly different degrees, was an acceptance of government intervention. Neoclassical economists had always been very sceptical, had always warned that if you have too much government intervention in the markets, they may cause more problems than they cure. In the 1970s, a whole host of problems beset the global economy. There was a slowdown in the Western world. The Soviet Union's economy began to collapse, and Eastern European communism began to collapse with it. In China, the Chinese economy began to slow down. And in the developing world started to go backwards. It had shown signs of progress in the immediate post-war period, but in the 1970s, there was a whole host of problems. From the mid-1970s until 2008, take that as a watershed year, we can see the evolution of the global economy as having been heavily dominated by the neoclassical view that what we needed to do was to try to remove the states from the running of the economy and have much greater room for the operation of markets. These sets of policies came to be referred to as the Washington Consensus. Up until 2008, One could have argued that that did now seem to be a new consensus, a way of dealing with policy. Then came the global financial crisis of 2008. For many people, the global financial crisis of 2008 has brought about an urgent need to reassess what the boundaries between the market and the state should be, particularly then, far from removing the state from the operation of markets, a growing consensus seems to be that we need to reconsider when and where it's appropriate for states to intervene in the running of the market.